morning. Glad to see you all on this Friday morning. Representative Worth asked that we do 97 and 98 last. Okay, then I tell you what. Let's do 31, 34 first, since we have Commissioner Milne here, who I'm sure has other demands on her time. I don't know. Let me open a public hearing on House Bill 3134. Is that yours, Paul?
Yes.
You're staffing us today?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I did bring some.
Okay. Go ahead.
House Bill 3134 is grants counties the right to sell tax lien certificates on properties to investors. It's on properties that have had a lien attached to them for more than a year. And investors who purchase the certificates acquire the right to receive payment of delinquent taxes plus interest and penalties. The bill also gives the Department of Revenue rulemaking authority, and I did ask John Phillips to look into that a little bit. We've actually done a little bit of work on this in the interim and found that we did look at five states, Arizona, Minnesota, Colorado, Iowa, and Florida, that have relatively advanced tax certificate programs, and this seems to be a program that is used in a number of states.
Okay. I think we'll hear about some of those other states.
Hey.
Good morning.
Oh, good morning.
Commissioner Milne.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members, and thank you very much for the opportunity to present House Bill 3134. My name is Patty Milne. I live in Woodburn. I'm currently a Marion County Commissioner. Mm-hmm. I am here on my own behalf this morning, however.
I guess I'm pleased you remember how to do that.
Yeah, I was trying to remember, yes. as is usually the case, and it was my experience when I was a representative and did serve with Representative Shetterly and know some of you from other arenas, but it always appeared to me that most often the really good legislation, good ideas, for particularly too for local government, come from people's own personal experiences. Well, we in Marion County do rely very much on property taxes. That's our general fund. And we certainly want, particularly in the current climate, we want every dollar and we want it now. As I've been a county commissioner for 5 years now, the assessment and taxation process is one that I have found a little fascinating. It is cumbersome. And every budget year, our assessor, and of course our assessor is here this morning, spends a great deal of time and effort, and sometimes it gets to be a little frustrating of a process and a little tedious. And there are forms that must be filled out for the Department of Revenue. And I will say the Department of Revenue is wonderful. They have been excellent in supplying the help and the expertise that's needed in filling out what sometimes can be rather complicated. Without going into a great deal of discussion of what that process is and how it works, however, it's those fines from the delinquencies that go to the state, not to the county, and then the Department of Revenue divvies it up. And it's based on formulas and very much also the performance of the local assessor's office. And again, we're grateful that we have done well the years I've been there. The current fiscal year, Marion County has received $878,000 from that process, and this, in effect, subsidizes our assessor's work as well as some other county services. However, past due from the previous year, we have $5.7 million. That is currently delinquent. If we had this program, House Bill 3134, in effect today, we would most likely be able to collect $2 to $3 million. Now, wouldn't you rather have $2 to $3 million instead of $878,000 in order to help balance your general fund budget, in order to provide those services that your county is so desperately trying to make ends meet to support? This has been a frustrating process for all of us, and budgets are tight everywhere. I don't need to tell you that. When Mr. Valkema came to visit with me several months ago, and said, why can't we do this in Marion County? Why doesn't the state of Oregon have this wonderful program that many other states currently have? I have to tell you, I thought it was a no-brainer. This is a win-win program for everyone involved. It does provide relief to the county. The money comes to the county that is owed to the county. For an investor, an individual such as yourselves or anyone here in this room, it's an opportunity for you to make an investment and to help your community. The property owner, there is no change whatsoever to process or the property owner's ability to get caught up to date and retain their property. There's absolutely no change for the property owner. So I thought this appeared to be something that we really ought to be looking at and make certain that we can maximize what is owed through property taxes to our counties and help better balance our county budgets. This does seem like a no-brainer to me. And Mr. Volkema, if you would please
come. And actually, Ms. Volkema signed up too. Are you going to testify? Yeah. Come on forward. We've got three chairs.
And Mr. and Mrs. Volkema are the experts. They've had approximately 20 years of experience doing this, so I would really prefer to turn this over to them.
But if you'll stay there, then we'll ask you questions when you're all three done. Okay.
Okay, my name is Jim Volkema. My employment is in Marion County Sheriff's Department, but my wife and I have been investing in these tax lien certificates in Arizona for approximately 20 years when we first started doing it. One of the aspects that we like about this is it does not raise any new taxes. We're only collecting the taxes that are only owed to the counties now that are sitting on the books just in limbo. Pinal County, which is a small county in Arizona, this year, as the handouts I gave you would show, that on February 6th, one day and one day only, they took in $1.65 million on tax lien sales. Like Commissioner Milton said, which would you rather have, a $1.6 million, $2, $3 million, or $878,000 that the state currently gives to the taxing district of the county? The next handout I have given you is copies of some of the treasurer's deeds or tax lien certificates, if you will, that I've got currently. And there's true, I'm as an investor, I'm looking out for my wallet as well as looking out for the county's benefit of collecting this money now. And I get 16% interest if I hold these certificates a year. If they get redeemed prior to that year, then they get the homeowner pays 1.33% per month as to for their fees in me paying their amount of taxes. So it's beneficial for me as an investor. It's really beneficial to the counties and your schools and your fire and police departments, because they're getting that money up front from a third party, me. And the other packet I have for you is how it's called the Pinal County Treasurer Tax Lien Sale Information Booklet. It tells you exactly how it's done. So after we have this hearing today, if any of you would like to invest your money, you know how, because I just gave you a packet on how to do it. The big push that we have here is the fact that the property tax lien sale has so many benefits to it with very little downside for the county as a whole, for the state, because we're relieving the DA from having to take civil procedure of foreclosure and his staff and resources to do this, and turning it over to the investor, because it becomes part of the investor's issues that he or she has to deal with. Also, the county and all across Oregon is saying, well, we got to lay off staff because of budget cuts. Well, if they had this extra revenue coming in, that would help to eliminate some of that layoffs in staff. It would also help to curtail some of the cutbacks on programs, the essential programs to our elderly and stuff that we need to do. because we're committed to help our elderly and our less fortunate people in the community. And it brings tourism to the state because out-of-state investors would be pouring in here. As you all are aware, stock market's down. Your portfolios are going in the hole financially. This is a way to reinvent the wheel, if you will, as far as getting your portfolios going back up. PERS was another prime example. There's been a lot of debate about PERS over the last year, year and a half. And PERS also is in the portfolio issue of the stock market. And we're paying people to manage that money to basically lose money for us. And now they're saying, well, let's revamp PERS. Let's quit paying these people guaranteed 8% interest on the Tier 1 scale, which I'm one of them. And if the PERS department would invest their money into this type of scenario, they're guaranteed 16% interest on their money. Paying that 8% would be very minimal. The other 8% or fraction thereof that they would get could go into their fund to keep PERS alive and well. Like Commissioner Mellon said, this is a no-brainer, really. Why the tax collectors are against it, it's mainly the same old shoe. We don't want to change. This is the way we've been doing it for years. Why should we change? Well, everybody knows your life changes from day to day, month to month. Nothing ever stays the same. And this is a way to benefit some of that change to help the county, help the taxpayers. And I can go into great more detail on how this system works, the mechanics of it, at another meeting. I know you're limited for time here. So
You give us just a real quick, I've glanced through the booklet here, but these certificates go on sale once a year. You get a notice ahead of time. You become a bidder.
Okay, I will...
Walk us through real, just, you know, maybe one property, how it might work.
Okay. The county treasurer makes up a list of the properties that are delinquent and available for sale. They automatically, now this, I'm going to use Arizona because that's where I'm familiar with. The properties are automatically 2 years delinquent at the time of the sale. The list goes to publication in a small paper of general distribution. It's a weekly paper down
like
there.
Counties now publish the foreclosure list.
Right. In the Jefferson Review, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Then once that list is published, they set the date for the actual sale. The sale is a Dutch auction sale. Now, what this curtails to is the treasurer starts the bidding at 16%. Each individual investor, if they want that property, then they can bid down the interest. That's when my handouts show that if I really want that property, I'm going to bid zero interest. Now, what that does, I only get my money back if the people pay up. Now, the 16% interest that's still being charged to the property owner will then revert to the county. They would keep that 16% because I voted not to have any. Now, as my interest goes up...
16% is the statutory rate on the...
Yes, it is.
Arizona. What's the statutory rate here in Oregon?
16%. So that's not going to change.
Okay, right.
The only difference is who gets
I understand.
That 16%.
Yeah, okay.
Then, once I get the winning bid, whether it be 16% or zero and anywhere in between, then I go pay the treasurer's office my amount of money that I bid. The delinquent taxes that are owed on the property
plus
is what
fees,
I should say.
Expenses, public fees,
right.
And all that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. They have a $5 fee to issue me a tax lien certificate over a certain dollar amount. Then up to that certain dollar amount, then from there over, it's a $10 fee. So the county gets a little more money there to offset the cost of the sale.
Right.
Basically some administrative fees.
Yeah, sure.
Right. And the sale is originally set up for 2, possibly 3 days. I have been to several of these sales. They've lasted 1 day and 1 day only because once the treasurer goes through the list as much as they can, he'll get to a point where the lull in the bidding stops, and he'll say, okay, is anybody interested in any particular properties? And then he'll deal with them. And as soon as nobody's interested in anything, he's called to sale at an end, stop. Then what happens is a week later, because it takes a week for the employees to go ahead and process all those that have been sold, then he opens it up to all year long, any investor can come across the counter and buy them if they're still available. And when you buy them after the sale, it's an automatic 16%. There's nobody bidding against you for that time, you know, that interest rate.
So now you don't have a deed. You have a lien certificate.
You have no deed to the property. You have no right to go onto the property. Right. Nothing. You cannot build on it. All you have is like a mechanic's lien, basically, except it's a tax lien. And it's a first lien, which means any mortgages and stuff that's on that property, if you are successful going 5 years and taking it to court to foreclose, they're all wiped out. So you're getting it for basically pennies on the dollar, free and clear.
Is that the same status as tax liens currently on the property here in Oregon? Do they have a... John Phillips can answer, I guess. Do they have a priority over all other voluntary encumbrances?
What?
Oh, we can find that out. Okay. But
during the court process, they serve...
You could give us your name.
My name is Tony Valtima. I also am an interested citizen and investor in Arizona tax property. During the sale process, when you buy a property, you have to pay the taxes that are owing all the way back to whatever year the property went delinquent. And according to this sheet from the Marion County Tax Collection Department, some of the property with unpaid taxes go back to 1988. So the investor would have to pay the taxes all the way from 2001 back to 1988. At that time, the interest at 16% would start for the investor. The interest on all the years prior to 2003 would still belong to the state. During the actual going to court process, the owner of the property has to be served. If you can't find them to serve them personally, you serve by publication. Then you have to go to court. They have to get a title report showing who has an interest in the property, including mortgage holders.
No, this is after the redemption period has expired.
Right, after 5 years has expired.
And you've not been paid because they can redeem at any time up to the redemption.
Right.
Okay,
right.
So the same process the county goes through.
Yes.
Well, not same necessarily, but I mean, it's analogous to what the county goes through.
In this program, it is the investor's responsibility to do all of the foreclosure process. So that would relieve the county. The county would no longer have to expend time, energy, and other resources to follow through on that process.
Let me ask, who's responsible for the taxes during the redemption period? I mean, you pay the delinquent taxes. Let's assume that you've got somebody who's not motivated to pay the next year's taxes in the property. Okay, are you responsible for them?
As an investor, that's a two-step question because let's say I buy up 5 years of back delinquent taxes at one shot. Then the next year, on June 1st, I can go in and I can do a subsequent tax for like 2002, okay? Because in February of this year, they sold the 2001 taxes. June 1st, I can go in and subtax 2002 to keep that certificate off the list for the next year.
Okay.
Now,
but no other investor can buy it at that point as long as you do the subtax.
As long as you do the subtax. Now, let's say I do this for a couple of years, but it's before the five-year window where I can foreclose. All of a sudden, my circumstances change, and I need my money back. Well, it's like a CD. I can't just tell them, okay, here's my certificate. I want my money back. But what I can do as an investor is don't subtax the next year, and when it goes back on the sales block at the list for the sale, then some other investor can step in, buy that certificate, and buy all my certificates out. I get my money back, my interest, and they basically step into my shoes of when I bought the first certificate.
Right, and that's your incentive to keep the taxes current.
Sure.
Because if you don't, someone else will.
Right.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative.
I'm curious how this affects a homeowner or a guy who's been laid off and behind a couple of years, or businesses often fall into these situations. And so how does this make life better for those people?
Well, it's not really making it better. It's just not changing it. The taxes are delinquent now, even though no one is paying them for the homeowner. They're still owing by the landowner under this program. The lien certificate holder pays the taxes on the own landowner's behalf, but the landowner still owes the money to the county. If they pay that money, then the county sends the money back to the investor. If it goes on to court process, the owner has to be notified of the court process, and he has the opportunity to pay up then. They also go to the title insurance office and find out who has interest in the property, like the mortgage holder, and they would also be served. So if the homeowner can't pay up the taxes, the mortgage holder can pay the taxes to keep from losing that mortgage money.
So as I understand this, if I do, this doesn't change the nature of the obligation for the property owner.
This is
all between the county and the investor, and it's essentially an assignment. The county is assigning its rights in those taxes, basically, to the investor, and the investor is paying those taxes to the county and then stepping into the county's shoes, essentially, so that from there on out the process really is the same as it would be as if the county was still proceeding with foreclosure, and the person in the property, the property owner, their liability really doesn't change because of this.
There's no adverse issue with them.
Yeah.
Actually, the landowner doesn't necessarily even know that there's an investor involved.
Okay. It doesn't matter. You make a mortgage on the house, the person you made the mortgage with, 9 times out of 10, don't keep your mortgage.
Sure.
They sell it to
someone else.
Party investor.
And that doesn't change the mortgage obligation.
No, the only thing it does is change the address, your mail, your payments.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, if I could, excuse me, also add, when you were talking about, in a sense, this is the county assigning, I'm not certain that would quite reflect. Actually, what it is the investor saying, I'm going to take responsibility and pay the county what the county has been entitled to.
Right.
So it relieves the county of uncollected debts. It pays those delinquent monies that the county has not been able to collect.
But then the county essentially assigns the county's foreclosure rights, basically, so that if they don't pay, then the investor can foreclose. Or the county would have at the end of the road.
Which is
that frees up the dollars.
Yeah, no, I understand. Yeah, no, I'm not arguing with that.
Spend that money or time.
Mm-hmm. Right. Basically, what the investor's doing is providing interim financing.
Right.
So
mm-hmm.
the county can operate on an ordinary basis as though the taxes mm-hmm. were paid, and they don't have to pay interest for this interim financing. Actually, the landowner is paying the interest, which partly goes to the county and partly goes to the investor.
And then I guess that in the event the property goes to foreclosure, it's the investor paying the foreclosure costs and
yes.
the county paying the foreclosure.
Right.
Yes,
exactly.
Which is a huge
everything. Now, in the foreclosure process, if the landowner answers the complaint and says, well, I'm going to pay up my taxes, then he's also obligated to pay the interest, court costs, attorney's
sure.
fees of the investor.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So as an investor, I lose no money.
But again, the property owner would do that, would have to pay those
yes.
fees to the county,
yes.
too, if the county foreclosed.
Now, the other big benefit is if this law was put into place, you're automatically going to see a lot of these people that have delinquent money outstanding running down to the tax office mm-hmm. to pay it. Because if you've got a piece of property worth $150,000, are you going to let an investor have it for $5,000 or $10,000? Probably not. You're going to go down there and pay up those taxes and keep them current. Therefore, it kind of sets the investor off for a while.
Mm-hmm.
So it benefits two directions here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and on the sheet from Marion County, it shows the back taxes for each year going up. The top year is 1988-89. Right now, if this was Arizona property, the property from 1998 and older is old enough to go to court. So
and that,
all of those prior
me.
Years would
Tony,
be paid at once.
And tell the committee what the amount is on
oh.
those.
Okay.
The amount of money just here in Marion County that
okay.
we're talking
from
about.
From 1988 to the year 2002, I tallied up all this money that's still outstanding, and it comes to $11,006,000. of that $11 million, if this bill was in place and we did a little bit of news media advertising about how this works, how it would benefit investors, I see no reasonable reason why we couldn't bring in at least $5 to $6 million of that the first year. That would reduce that substantially. And even in the 2002 to 2003 year, now these figures are as of the 31st of December last year, the outstanding uncollected taxes in Marion County was $32.98 million. Of that $32.98 million, since they're not delinquent until May 15th, I'm anticipating over $60 million of that is not going to get paid this year because of our economy.
But it's also too new to be sold.
And yes, it's too new to be sold. It'll be 2 years down the road or next year before you could sell it. But the issue is you're seeing under these numbers that figure keeps climbing every year. We're trying to eliminate that climb, basically what we're doing.
I think we've got a good exposition. I think we had a couple questions up here. Representative Virgin, do you have a question?
I did. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wondered how many people where you have invested, because you've been investing quite a while, how many bankruptcies have been subsequent to your buying?
Okay, number one on bankruptcies, the treasurer, when he advertises the properties that are for sale, at the end of the advertisement of the listing of that property, they put a B, and at the bottom they explain the B is in bankruptcy. They can't sell that certificate until that bankruptcy is cleared. Once the bankruptcy is cleared, then they can sell it. But if in my experience, the people that go through bankruptcy, which wipe out all their other debt, actually come back in and pay up their taxes, which keeps it on the tax roll, and investors very, very seldom ever get one that's in bankruptcy.
And in fact, I see the bankruptcy is actually addressed in on page 10 of the...
That's why I asked the question.
It scared me. No, actually, bankruptcy benefits the homeowner or the landowner because it gives them more time to come up with the money to pay up once their bankruptcy is discharged.
Okay, and another thought there. During the bankruptcy process, the mortgage holder or anyone who has interest in the property is made aware of the bankruptcy.
Right.
So the mortgage holder is going to pay up those taxes even if the landowner doesn't, because they don't want to lose out.
Right.
And at any time during the process, during bankruptcy or otherwise, the landowner can either sell his house or refinance, and the mortgage company will see that the taxes are owed and they'll have to be paid during the process.
Okay. Anything else to wrap up on this panel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, panel, for listening to this. To just follow up on what Mr. Volcamo was saying, these are delinquent taxes in Marion County, and the total to date was $32,980-some.
For that year only.
Just one of 36.
Okay. And to put this in perspective, our general fund in Marion County is $89 million. Can you imagine how we could turn around the health of the county general fund? And of course, I think it's understood as you look at putting in place any new program, it takes time. It takes time for people to understand the program is in place, and it would allow also for any changes that would be minor, as was commented on, whether it be within the county itself, the assessor's office, the treasurer's office. These are minimal and very, very low cost changes, particularly relative to the money that could be realized. And then with regard to, we would still probably be dealing with some delinquencies that the Department of Revenue would be working with the county. So that wouldn't be eliminated, that process, I don't imagine, but it would be tremendously reduced and, again, very, very cost-effective all the way around for the state and the counties.
And we've been talking pretty much about Marion County, but this actually affects every county.
Sure.
In the Portland area, you got the tri-counties up there. Imagine how much money they would take in every year. Medford, same thing in Jackson County. Anywhere where you have a lot of populace, they have a lot of outstanding tax delinquency. Your smaller counties over in eastern Oregon, maybe not as much. I don't know. I haven't checked with them. But even if we could only accumulate statewide $50 to $100 million off this, That's that much money the state general fund doesn't have to give the counties to shore them up.
All right.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony on that. Let's bring up John Phillips for some techno speak. John, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. John Phillips with the Department of Revenue. Just to answer your question, the property tax lien would take priority over other existing liens on the property or future liens on the property, except for Internal Revenue Service.
As it does now. Existing. That doesn't change the priority.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. The department is not taking a position on this bill, but we're just here to provide some information about the process and try to answer any questions that might come up. Provided some handouts, and I wanted to touch on three issues and then maybe some issues that could be dealt with in an administrative rule. I want to point out that the bill uses the word may in the first part of the sentence, so it does allow counties, it doesn't require counties to sell these certificates. And that's, I think that's important for the bill, too, and leaves the counties the decision to make on this issue. Property taxes do become delinquent, but not until after the third trimester, which means if the lien goes on July 1st, 2002, last July, they will not become delinquent until this coming May 16th. So the way I read the bill, the sale can occur 1 year from the date the tax lien is attached, and I'm not 100% certain on that, but it seems to me that would be this coming July 1st would be the 1 year from the date the lien was placed on the property. And if it's talking about the lien for the taxes that went on last July 1st, then the 1 year would expire this coming July. If it's talking about a different kind of tax lien than the one that's already on the property or in current law, then that might be different. So that might be different than the Arizona situation. As a practical matter, most counties would be willing to sell these liens on a lot of different types of properties, I think. Mobile homes, of course, that like a 1972 mobile home, for example, or maybe personal property where the company's left the state, or possibly contaminated property. There are a lot of types of property that counties would be more than happy to sell, but those properties are mostly uncollectible. The real property, I think, is where this is going to focus. The interest is going to focus on real property. And most of the property, for example, in Polk County last year, 95% of the taxes not collected within 45 days, and that's what I mean. They're delinquent May 16th, so by July 1st, 95% of the real property taxes had been collected. So we're talking, just to give you a sense, we're probably talking about 5% of the property taxes, and I'm not diminishing that notion at all. I'm just trying to give you a sense of how much is there. That amount would then be available for sale. We have a list for Marion County after the foreclosure process of about $10,000 left over to be collected after the foreclosure process, which is in Oregon about a 6-year process.
$10,000?
$10,000, yes. I think on the example, let's see if I have that. I don't think that's in your handout, but I have an example of Marion County's delinquency for the various years. And back to 95-96, the real property, and this is just real property, delinquent taxes from 95-96 tax year owing today are $10,049. So.
Where are you looking, John?
I'm sorry. I didn't provide that handout, but okay. I have it here, okay. And I can get it to you. Just to give you a sense of the real property, because I think this bill would focus on the collection of real property primarily, real property delinquent taxes. And I did include a handout that shows the collection percentages by county as of June 30th at the end of this past tax year. Not the current tax year, because we won't know these numbers until this coming June 30th. So, and those are by county. And then I provided a little graph, this graph here, which shows Multnomah specifically. Sent this down to me. So cash flow is an issue. There is that money that could come in. The county does bear the cost of these collection efforts. The local governments don't. So it is an issue for counties in particular, as opposed to the other types of districts. Collection is virtually certain over a period of time, but as I said, cash flow is the second point that I wanted to cover. And there have been attempts over the years to deal with this cash flow issue, and one way to deal with it is to shorten the foreclosure time frame. Another is to create a tax lien sales, which would speed up those collections. So those are two methods that have been brought up in the past. Paul referred to earlier efforts in this area, and Senate Bill 250 from the 95 session also brought the same tax lien sale issue before you. There's a lag beginning with the fiscal year and the receipts of the tax collection July to approximately November 30th. If you're a local taxing district, and many of you have worked in local governments, you know that fiscal year begins July 1st and your tax revenues don't come in until November, the end of November, you've got a cash flow situation. And a lot of districts either carry over balances, like unappropriate ending fund balances, or they'll purchase tax anticipation notes, which come at a cost. So that's one way a lot of local governments deal with that, is they buy these notes and then fund themselves through that period of time. This would bring more money earlier on and possibly alleviate that situation. I personally don't know what the interest rates they're paying on those notes are, but that's something we could look into. I did look back to see how long this foreclosure process, this 3 year of foreclosure process and then 2 year of redemption has been in place, just because it is, you know, if we were to shorten that, it would collect more money probably earlier on. And I did find only back to 1935, there was laws dating back to then when it went from a 5 year to a 3 year process. But beyond that, I'm not really sure how far back that process goes. The third point I wanted to make was about the County Assessment and Taxation Funding Account. And this is an account that was established originally in 1989, which was set up to fund county assessment and taxation functions. As the commissioner mentioned, and it's a very valid point, counties do bear the cost of these collection and assessment efforts. And so if there's bankruptcy filing, if there's DA work that needs to be done, foreclosure list publishing, the county bears those costs, and the other local governments don't. This fund was set up because not only values were skewed statewide because there was lack of effort, but because it provided additional revenue for the assessment function, because the local governments that get most of the property tax money don't actually pay for that service. They don't pay to have someone collect their money for them. That's provided by the county under law. So this funding account was set up, and it's funded by two methods. One is delinquent interest, and two is reporting fees. And delinquent interest makes up about 70%+ of the funds that are collected through that process. Each quarter, the counties send into the Department of Revenue the collections on those from those two sources, and the department then reallocates those monies, as the commissioner mentioned, and then sends those back out to the county. I did include an example of the distributions for you and in the handout. And I just highlighted Coos County received $157,990 on page 2 of that handout for the quarterly distribution from a total of $3.9 million. So some of the money that, just for your consideration, that is being discussed here would not be coming in the form of delinquent interest. I think it's probably more than obvious to say that there would be no delinquent interest collected if there were no delinquent interest paid. So that's something that would not fund that account. And just for your consideration about how those revenues would either be made up or maybe a different funding source or just done away with altogether, some considerations. As part of that, the department does receive some of that money, just to be sure that you know that. The counties share in that money, but the department also shares in that money. And we appraise the all utility property in the state of Oregon and all the large industrial for a total of just about $30 billion of value statewide. And then that money then is on the county rolls and then generates property tax revenue. So we are funded partially out of that program. There are administrative details, because we would have rule writing authority from the department to sort of implement this. And there are questions. We'd want to be clear on the date at which the tax liens could be sold. Like I said, I think it might be 1 year after the beginning of the tax year. because the lien was on the first day of the tax year. There's other issues like how whether or not taxes could be compromised, and I think the proponents made it clear that maybe taxes would not be compromised, but this was not clear to me from reading the bill, and so possibly this would not be an issue. If they're purchasing the lien for the value of the interest, that's one thing. If they're purchasing the lien for the for a discounted value of the tax, that would be another. So maybe that question's been answered. Wasn't clear to me in the bill. The current law provides for taxes to be paid to the oldest year, so there might be some need to address that. If taxes are then paid to the county for current year taxes and the lien exists for previous year's taxes and that had not been satisfied, we would have to write a rule or decide how to apply tax payments made after a tax lien was sold. There might be an issue around once the tax lien is sold, then we would assume that it's possible, I'm not sure, but it's possible that lien would then take precedence because it was prior in time to future current year taxes delinquency. And that could be worked out too. It's just I'm just trying to raise issues that we would have to address in some kind of rulemaking and instructing the counties. And then whether or not there'd be any notice requirements to owners to say, like if I agree that my mortgage company can sell my mortgage, would there be any kind of legal requirements for us to notify, for the state to notify homeowners that their tax lien was sold? I don't know the answer to that either, so we have to look into that. So those are just some of the issues and considerations for your
questions for Mr. Phillips. All right, good list of issues to work on. Thank you, John. Diane Bell. Are you going to bring that little black cloud with you and rain all over this thing now? Isn't that the process?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, I am the dreaded tax collector from Washington County, Diane Belt. I represent the Oregon Association of County Tax Collectors, and I do the personal property collections for Washington County. This issue has come before the legislature in prior years, and the county's tax collectors have always opposed this, and we continue to do so. I do know that the tax lien certificates are offered in several other states because we do get a lot of calls from folks that are inquiring about investing in county tax liens. And it is where my understanding of how the process works is that the unpaid tax is sold and the collection rights are sold to an investor. And it's been brought up, and I'll just touch on it again. Basically, at the end of the first year, our collection rate is between 94 and 95%. In the last couple of years, I can say that has increased. There's been a substantial amount of refinance because of the lower interest rate. So we have seen an increase in our collectibles, and we have seen a decrease in our foreclosures consistently over the last 3 or 4 years. A property owner has 6 years in which to pay their property taxes, and I think the one thing that we haven't talked about here today that I would like to touch upon is the property tax, the owner of that home, because we do deal with those people on a daily basis. In the 25 years I have been in the collection business, 14 of which was with Yamhill County, we've never taken anybody's home because people will get their taxes paid, so we've never taken anybody's home. Washington County did foreclose on 3 homes, but they were abandoned homes that somebody had left with a fairly substantial IRS lien. We were fortunate enough to sell them to pay off the IRS so that the county didn't have to come up with those funds. So I think we also, in the back of our minds, need to think about the taxpayer that owns this piece of property, because my understanding of the way the process looks is that this investor does have an opportunity to foreclose on that property as the county would. So I think we need to remember the taxpayer. I think that in some states this process works well because each taxing district is their own collector. They do their own billing. They do their own collections. in our state, we are the collecting agents for all of the districts, so we do the books for those folks. So I could see where certificates would work well in a situation like that.
I mean, like Oregon?
No.
Would it be more complicated if you had to buy a certificate from a school district and from a water...
Mr. Chair, I think what I'm...
district and a city and county? Isn't it easier when you have just all of it in one...
No, Mr. Chair, what I'm saying is, like, if you were a small district that had some delinquent taxes, that district would benefit by selling the tax lien.
Well, I guess my question is, how could you foreclose just the water district's taxes? I mean, what good does it have to have a tax lien certificate for the school district, for instance? You can't foreclose that discrete from. You'd have to go out and buy all the other certificates in order to be able to foreclose the property, wouldn't you?
Mr. Chair, I'm just speaking of somebody that talked to me from Tennessee that said they loved it.
It seems like this is the more streamlined way.
Probably is. Yeah. Probably is. The process does create another layer of administration for the county offices, because when you read the bill, it does talk in paragraph 2 that the investor that purchases the certificate has the right to receive payments of the delinquent taxes plus the interest and penalties. So that would mean that we would also have to track the certificate owner to be sure that they get any payments. I believe the Florida model that we looked at several years ago, we would end up having two sets of accounts, basically, because we would still have to bill the property owner, plus we would still have to keep track of any payments and disperse those to the tax certificate owner. So that does create another layer of administration for the county office.
Let me ask Diane, since this is a county option, I guess that's something the county would encounter on its, I mean, that's part of the decision-making process, isn't
sure.
it? I mean, you could go to your own county commissioners and persuade them that this is just a nightmare for us. We don't want to do this because we can't manage it. Whereas Commissioner Milne's assessor might go to her and say, hey, this is best thing since sliced bread. Let's do it. What's so offensive about that when it's on a county-by-county basis, at least in terms of the administrative aspect of that?
Mr. Chair, because of all 36 counties, we just found out about this hearing the other day. There probably would have been 36 tax collectors here to say that we don't want to get into this. The only downside I could see is if you had a county where there was a board of commissioners that said that this was something that we wanted to do, my only concern would be then we have 35 counties that don't do it and one that does, where our foreclosure process is pretty well lined out in the statutes and everybody follows the same publication dates, the same notification, the same billings. It's consistent, where now we would lose consistency because we would have one county that's offering a tax certificate sale and 35 that don't. But also, the other problem I can see with the bill is it doesn't provide a funding source for the implementation and administrative costs of the bill. And also, for your convenience, this was forwarded to me several months ago. It's a ban on tax lien sales resurfaces, and this is out of the Atlanta Journal. So I do know that the state of Georgia is in the process of trying to get out of the tax lien certificate business. And that, I thought, was kind of interesting. It shows the pros and cons. But I thought the last paragraph kind of sums it up. And I would answer any questions.
Yeah.
I guess I'm having a hard time feeling that you're taking advantage of someone who hasn't paid their taxes since 1988 when you have, in the case that was presented to us from Marion County, they were talking about back taxes to 1988. And then in the article that you gave us, the last comment that you just referred to is, you're taking advantage. I don't like taking advantage of people. I guess that it's a little hard for me when you realize that a lot of people pay their taxes over and above new school clothes, vacations, everything else, because that's their obligation to pay. How are we taking advantage of a person who simply refuses to pay the county when it's their obligation? I missed that connection.
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, the 1988 tax liability is probably manufactured housing, which I would love to sell the manufactured home tax roll and the personal property.
Probably a lot of investors to buy that.
Yeah, but unfortunately, we don't have a lot of people stepping up to the plate for those. On the real property, those taxes are foreclosed and deeded to the county after 6 years. The properties we receive are typically contaminated and small mapping strips that have been remapped. The people that I talk to with delinquent taxes are not people that just refuse not to pay their tax. They are people that maybe they've lost their job, but for some reason it's that they don't want to pay their tax. It's that they can't afford to pay their tax at this time. But they do get their tax liability paid. And
so
they,
with this bill, it doesn't change the timing of the foreclosure process for them. It's still the same for them. Mm-hmm. So what is the advantage that's being taken here? I mean, they're not going to, again, the foreclosure process isn't going to occur any sooner under this bill than it does under current law. So what's the harm to the property owner?
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
Representative Cheverly, it's been a long day, and it's only Friday. I guess when I... Like I say, we have never taken anybody's home, and I can't think of any county that really has foreclosed on anybody's home. Multnomah County's taken a few drug houses and things like that, but once again, it's nothing that anybody wants. In this case, my fear is that people will lose their homes.
But is that because county's just letting people kind of go on and on and on and not pay taxes?
Mr. Chair, no. People pay their tax.
Okay.
People pay their tax. Manufactured housing is a little different.
Yeah, I understand, yeah.
But on real property, people pay their tax.
Okay. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I'm still a little confused. That's all right. Be patient with me here.
That's fine.
They still have the same advantage of paying the tax because I'm holding the lien, but they still can come around and pay the taxes, and a part of that keeps coming back to me, I believe, as they pay it. So it would only be if they absolutely refused that I could go into some type of foreclosure on their home.
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, that's true. But then on the other hand, I'm, as a county tax collector, I'm having to track both of those processes, which I don't have to do now. I collect those funds and I distribute them to the districts, and part of that interest comes back to help fund us. Whereas if you're a certificate purchaser, according to what it says in this bill, when you make a payment, let's say that you bought my tax lien, you bought my delinquent taxes, as I make a payment, as I understand this, to the county, I have to process that payment, plus I have to give it to you.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I'm looking at the trade-off in that you're going to sell a number of tax liens, which is going to solve your tax, your cash flow problem. So that's the trade-off here for the administrative work, is that you have more money into the county coffers.
Sure.
Is that?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, possibility. I guess, though, then I keep thinking about, okay, then we have taxes that keep accumulating because if this is somebody who is already having a financial hardship, then we have tax liability that keeps accumulating on the upcoming years. So then now I have two sets of problems. I have the certificate over here, and then I have the taxes that are levied over here, and I know they talked about, well, they could come in and pay those, and then they could put them on the tax lien certificate sale, and then they could sell that. And it just seems like the system that we have currently works very well. People don't lose their homes. The counties do collect their money, and we do it what I consider in a very timely fashion, because we don't have that large of a percentage. When you talk about $3 million, that $3 million does not come to the county. It goes to the separate taxing districts. The interest collected on that $3 million, 4% of that does come to the county to help fund assessment taxation.
Okay. We need to keep moving here. We've got some other things to do. There's good discussion. Thank you, Diane.
Yes.
Good to see you again. Last, we have up John Black.
Hey,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Blatt. I admit to come up here and testify purely as an individual and not representing my nonprofit organizations, but I've been asked twice already this morning about how this might affect nonprofit groups. So I'll start off with a comment to just say that this probably wouldn't have much of an impact on nonprofit groups and their development of affordable housing. Counties right now have the authority to forgive taxes, penalties, and interest and donate the property to nonprofit groups. I guess potentially it could make that pool smaller because if they sold these tax liens off, available properties to forgive taxes on and donate to nonprofits would be smaller. But we as an organization are not taking any position on this. My comments as a citizen and as an individual really relate only to the finance aspects of tax liens. I think that it makes sense. I mean, what you're really doing here, if you look at it from a finance standpoint, is you're securitizing future income so you can get it now. It's a very common business practice. People do this all the time. Wall Street makes millions of dollars off of helping people securitize future streams of income. But the main difference between what they do in those instances and what happens in this instance is that you not only securitize and sell off the potential income, you're also selling off the underlying asset to go with it. If I was a business, I would sell the interest in the income only and not the interest in the property. And so what you would be promising the investor then is that we as the seller, in this case the county, would at some point promise when that at maturity that you would get a certain amount. You would get the principal plus the interest at some future date. And you wouldn't sell off the interest in the property. The county would retain the property because that's the way a business would do it. They would sell off the interest in the income. And the investor would make the decision on how much they're willing to pay based on the income that is out there. And then you promise them a certain amount of the maturity date. It's simpler for the investor. They're not having to take over the property. They're not having to push the property through foreclosure. That would still be managed by the owner of by the county if it ever came to that, or if the property was paid off, the county could pay off the investor at that point.
But in this case, first county's argument, they don't have an interest in the real property itself. I mean, they have an interest just in taxes, and in fact, most counties don't want to own the property. So
right.
It's not as if they're selling an asset in that respect, a potential asset, I guess you would say, that they even want, because they don't want to own property.
Right. But it's a potential asset that's very valuable. I mean, I think the income is valuable because you have not only the principle of that embedded in the taxes that are due, but you have a guaranteed interest rate on return on those thing on that amount at 16%, and it also can't be erased by a bankruptcy. So you've got a very secure income generator there. And the question to an investor would just be, what is the net present value of the taxes plus 16% interest over the life of between now and whenever the maturity date would be? So in reality, once investors got used to this, I think investors would pay more than face value more than the taxes due, because the interest income is so high on these. So I think that I think it's a good process. I think it doesn't apply the business principles that it tries to apply. It only applies them part way, and that there are ways to apply this even more. And then the county would retain the property. So let's say you got to the end, close to the maturity date, and no one had paid. The county would still have the authority to go in, foreclose, resell the property, and pay off the investor at the end of this process. But the county would retain property, the right to do that, and not the investor. The investor would just be promised that at some specific time they would get a certain amount of income and paid back. So there's other things. I mean, the one in past workings, the one time this came up and caused a problem in community development type work was doing some work in Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C. was building a new convention center, some, 300,000 new square feet of convention center in the Shaw neighborhood. Shaw neighborhood is one of the poorest most violent neighborhoods in Washington, D.C. Lots of vacant housing. And this is vacant housing that's not just boarded up, but it's bricked up. I mean, the doors, the windows, and everything are completely bricked over. When the city got the financing together to do the convention center, they asked us in my previous job to come in and see if we could buy up a bunch of the housing around this property and fix it up to try to make it more attractive and prevent the gentrification that they were expecting in this area, because the new Wizards Arena is just a few blocks away. So they were expecting this to be a large gentrification. We went in, and in this case, the city had many years ago sold off the tax lien certificates on these properties. There was no value in the properties at that point. The investors foreclosed on the property, and with accumulated interest on the unpaid taxes, the investors were due $40,000 to $50,000 for each one of these houses. It made it virtually impossible for us to go in and buy them and rehab the properties. So giving up that asset of control over the property is a fairly significant thing. I just think that the current system that's used to sell tax lien certificates undervalues the asset when you look at a delinquent property and the potential income it can generate as an asset, it undervalues that asset.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Blatt?
Thank you very much.
Well, I appreciate everybody indulging us with this interesting conversation. I want to thank Commissioner Milne and the Balcombes for coming in today. We'll check with staff after this. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3134. Is Representative Worth out in the hall? I saw her a minute ago. Do you mind checking? If she is, we'll go to hers. Otherwise, we'll take up the work session. She is? Okay.
And so she's going to call.
Okay. You've got 97?
Okay.
We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3397. Paul?
Okay. Excuse me, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3397 modifies the statute to allocating the surplus kicker refund to individual income taxpayers. What it does is limit the tax liability which the kicker percentage would be applied to. And it limits it to $80,000 as a tax liability. And what I've done is I asked the Department of Revenue to run through the taxpayers that would be affected from the last kicker refund, the 6% refund that was paid out following the 9901 biennium. And it would affect a relatively small number of taxpayers, about 2,200. And if you have a liability of $80,000 and apply the 6% to it, that was the kicker refund that year, that would be $4,800. So you would, in essence, cap the kicker at $4,800, the kicker refund, or whatever percentage was applied to the $80,000. Then it would require the Department of Revenue to recalculate the surplus refund to reflect the cap. So they would those dollars that would have been distributed to people above $80,000 liability are added back in, and then you recalculate the percentage refund. So it would bump up the percentage refund for those that are below the $80,000 in tax liability.
Okay. Representative Worth. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Representative Kelly Worth, and I'm the state representative from House District 16. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today about House Bills 3397, and if it's all right, I'll just talk about them both together.
What, let me just open up a hearing on House Bill 3398 then, so you're free to talk about both.
So we'll do it more efficiently. And as you just heard from Mr. Warner, I've been talking with the Department of Revenue and Elizabeth and everybody about this bill for, it seems like, my entire life. And I guess there's two versions of it. And Paul's is one of them, and that's probably the correct version. But there, and I don't know. You know, I want to start a discussion on this, and I think that this is fine if we have two different versions. How I was looking at that bill is the $80,000 as an income amount and not a tax liability amount. So I'm going to go ahead and discuss it from that point of view, but it can certainly be discussed from another point of view.
Yeah, it is tax liability in the bill. Yeah.
Right. So anyway, so poor Dexter Johnson, I had him running around so much. I'm sure I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth to him at this point. So so I'm just going to go ahead and talk about the theory behind it all and start launch right in, and I'd be happy to answer any questions about anybody's version.
Yeah, if I can add, Mr. Chair, we do have a table that would reflect the adjusted gross income as well, and so interpreting it that way would affect about a little less than 12% of the filers.
Okay. So I want to begin with, obviously, we all know that the most important lesson Oregon's current economic decline has probably taught all of us is that our state's fiscal situation is the fault of a number of factors. Certainly contributing factors are PERS, the Oregon Health Plan, but a lot of it, as this committee well knows, are the structural problems with Oregon's revenue system. And in addition to our over-reliance on income tax as our primary source for funding central state services, the 2% surplus kicker law has also been identified as a serious structural problem that we need to address. And as you all well know, over the last just until recently, actually, Oregon was one of just a handful of states who, until just recently, did not have a rainy day fund. And I think it's fair to say that Oregon is the only state that has actually refunded its surpluses during the last several years of prosperous economic times. So while a number of people have told me over and over that this economic slump is no time to be discussing the kicker, I would submit that it's precisely the time to be discussing the kicker, along with all these other contributing factors that have put us in the economic crisis we currently find ourselves. And as you all well know, the kicker first passed in 1979 was originally distributed as tax credits, and then in 95 we moved to making these direct outlay payments to taxpayers, and in 2000, of course, the voters approved a legislative referral to put the kicker law into the Oregon Constitution. Conversation about the kicker up to this point, in my estimation, has been extremely polarized. In one camp, there are my people, my constituents, who on a daily basis call me and say, "Repeal the kicker. What are you doing up there? Why don't you repeal the kicker? Repeal the kicker every single day."
You represent Corvallis.
Exactly. And I say, "Well, I've got these two reform bills." "No, repeal the kicker." And, in fact, a number of my colleagues refused to sign on to co-sponsor these bills because they said, "Well, bring me an outright constitutional referral to repeal the kicker and I'll think about it." So that certainly represents one camp. And the other camp are those I like to likened to the firstborn child and the kicker, about the same thing. I mean, it's enshrined in the Constitution. It's extremely important to them. And any kind of talk of repeal is just outright ludicrous. So I haven't seen much in the way of really bringing those two camps together. So this bill, both these bills actually, are an attempt to look at moderate, modest statutory reforms. And given the threat that we might end up having a kicker this next biennium, given our economic crisis, I think it's imperative that we do address this, I think, long overdue discussion. So you can see that both of these bills focus their proposals for reform on those Oregonians who have benefited most from the prosperity and tax cuts of the last decade. And our wonderful legislative revenue office has put out this one chart you all have, the distribution of tax returns. And you can see that Oregonians since 1990 who make $60,000 and above, the number of filers, the number of returns have actually tripled. And those Oregonians filing returns making $100,000 and above, which is the last graph, have certainly exceeded the rate of any other income category. And in terms of the kicker itself, the richest 5% of Oregonians with taxable average taxable incomes of $254,000 received nearly 40% of the last kicker refund. Two-thirds of the kicker funds actually go to the most economically comfortable 20% of Oregon households. So that's why these two bills really focus on that income group. The first bill that Paul was just explaining, and Lizbeth did this other chart, you'll see, based upon the income distribution. And you'll see that under the existing law, each tax return received a kicker check of 6% of their tax year 2000 tax liability. Under the proposed limit of this bill, on the kicker check of, we looked at $300 because it was the average dollar amount per return for the kicker for all taxpayers having gross income of about $80,000. And as Elizabeth said, it's a nice round number. So that's what we looked at, the $80,000, and that's an average. $300 is your average kicker under the current law. So we're going to cap it, because what we want to do is you're not going to, it's silly to talk about excluding a group of taxpayers from getting their kicker. It's silly because it's not fair, and we're looking at addressing the equity argument here. Why should 40% of the kicker go to, you know, those making so much money? Well, the same argument should be made that those folks shouldn't be excluded completely. But what I would submit is a better equity argument is to stop the increase in proportionality at a certain level. And that $80,000 is, as we've just talked about, those folks have made, you know, have benefited over the last 10 years in terms of prosperity and tax cuts. So we want to cap the increase in proportionality at $80,000 of income in of Oregonians who make $80,000 and above. So the person who's making $80,000 gets the same amount of kicker as the person making $325,000 and above. Same amount kicker. So under existing law, you can see that each tax return received a kicker check of 6% of their tax year 2000 tax liability. And then under the proposed limit of the kicker check of 3000, the percentage of total tax liability for all returns range from 0.1% of income for those with incomes over $1 million to 13.2% for taxpayers with incomes between 25 and 30,000. So for joint tax returns, the limited kicker would yield a kicker as a percent of total tax liability of as much as 15.2% for four low-income groups. So it raises from 6% to those lowest income earners in Oregon up to 15.2%. So I like to say it puts more kick in the kicker. So you redistribute, you know, you have such a few income earners getting such a large portion of the kicker as it is now. So by capping that and saying, okay, those of you who have done the best over the last 10 years, those of you making $80,000 and above, you get the same amount of kicker as all of those income earners above you. Then we redistribute that amount, which is, again, you know, a huge chunk, over two-thirds. We redistribute that to the rest of Oregonians who have paid their taxes, and you end up getting, you know, well over twice as much kicker to those low-income earners who tend to spend their kicker check. They don't put it in the bank. They tend to use it as disposable income and could actually act as a stimulus in the economy. And then quickly, just the second bill goes back and looks at the possibility of, instead of using these direct outlays, of going ahead and returning the kicker to a tax credit. And again, focusing on those folks who have made $80,000 and above, and looking at it in terms of it, you'd have to opt in now for this tax credit. And the cost of the process to process and send out the kicker checks, in 2001, it was over $900,000. So this is getting at the cost. Obviously, we wouldn't have the printing the checks and sending the postage and everything. Their Department of Revenue will be up and talking about how they would have to have new software to process the credit, going back to the credit as opposed to the direct outlay. But we've done it before, so I don't see – and, you know, I'm open to the idea of making it a credit to everyone, but again, if we are constantly talking about the tax kicker as an economic stimulus, and it's, you know, there's argument back and forth, and it's not new money, so it can't be a stimulus. But I believe that if we really want this kicker to, if we don't want to get rid of it completely, and we want to keep it, we might as well make sure that it's going to those Oregonians who need it the most and who can actually use it to stimulate the economy by not putting it in the bank and actually using it as disposable income and actually help this economy through. So.
Okay. Questions for Representative Worth?
Nothing?
Nothing.
Well, I'll ask her a question. I'm just presuming that this is compatible with the law.
The Constitution?
And the Constitution. I mean, obviously, we don't want to start jumping through a lot of hoops in here, and the Constitution says you can't do it. So,
Representative Virgil, the statutory language determines the distribution of it. So I think it would be, you'd have to modify the statute without changing the Constitution. Where I think you would change the Constitution is if you change the total amount that was to be returned.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that would change that calculation.
Okay. That explains that.
Right, John, I've actually got a printout of the statute I can give you because it speaks correctly.
Well, I just presumed that, but sometimes, you know, you just assume and you better ask the question.
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jason Williams, you're up on 3397.
For the record, my name is Jason Williams, Executive Director of the Taxpayer Association of Oregon. And we just wanted to come in here and voice our opposition to House Bill 3397. As you know, the kicker was overwhelmingly voted on many years ago and then voted on again, put it in the Constitution. And, you know, this idea about trying to redistribute the wealth and kind of class warfare going on is something that just we feel is just very bad policy. I mean, if you're a grocery clerk, you not only want to get a kicker and have more money to spend in the economy, but you also want your boss and the person who owns the store to get more money. You also want your customers to get more money. We want the whole economy to benefit. And I don't like building a tax system where it penalizes you for being successful and it rewards you for keeping yourself in the same pool. There was an interesting poll there the other day done with the city of Portland and Multnomah counties. They've been trying to figure out what taxes they should do. And it was interesting that the voters were saying in the poll that they were more likely to support a tax on themselves rather than a tax on business. And there is I believe that the people of Oregon, taxpayers, realize that those entrepreneurs, those businesses, those successful people help push us to the next stage. I mean, it's very much a group effort. Every class is involved, but they really see the importance of nurturing entrepreneurs and driving that successful spirit. So I thought that was interesting that even those people that would be willing to take a tax themselves want to spare because they know that business and the entrepreneurs drive things. And, you know, this idea, as it was said just earlier, that, you know, this would tend not to put, you know, this would go to the people who need it the most because these other people would put it in the bank. I don't think a lot of people that receive their kicker check that are in the upper income just simply put it in the bank and don't do anything with it. They invest it, they spend it, just like everyone else. Just to assume that one class, people spend their kicker irresponsibly, I don't think we need to make that kind of judgment. And just finally, you know, there was a good cartoon I saw about Robin Hood talking to his men of Sherwood Forest and saying, well, now that we've looted the upper class, I guess we now have to work on the middle class now. And it kind of gets to the point where if you keep on trying to do this wealth redistribution, well, Nottingham is going to be full of unemployed people. So for us, let's just keep the flatter type of tax, the fair type of tax. Let's not penalize people for being successful in our entrepreneurs, because if we want to have those Fortune 500 companies, we want to have those people, once they just start a fantastic idea and they're just rolling with it, we don't want to have anything to stop them. They're paying their fair percentage. They need to be rewarded just like everybody else. So thank you.
All right. Any questions for Jason? Representative?
Thank you. I know you didn't testify on 3398, but
that bill would allow a credit on your form as opposed to a check, which would save the state money. You're not opposed to that, are you?
We haven't. We're just beginning now to understand the bill. If it's an all fairness thing, it just helps the state save money and it doesn't create more complexity or bureaucracy. I could see us, saying we have no problem with the bill, but we just haven't had enough time to look at it, and so.
Okay. Anything else, Jason? Just the shades to not pertinent to this bill particularly, but your comment about penalizing people who, penalizing income and income-producing activities, that is precisely what our income tax system does. I mean, there are other ways to look at a revenue system that doesn't penalize income-producing activities. I know you're addressing your comments to this bill in particular, but that could be a comment that you could make about our system in general.
Yeah, Chair Shetterly, members of the committee, I mean, the closer we get to a flat tax and more fair tax, I think it benefits everybody.
Broader tax.
Okay.
Come on, Jason, go there. Go
there.
Thank you, thank you. Thank you, members of the committee. I'll,
here's a nice little piece of cheese, Jason, if you want. Thank you. Okay, anybody else wish to testify? Joe.
Oh, no, you could.
You could.
I could, actually. Joe.
Actually, Joe, you could. You really could.
Just to make a few comments, Mr. Chairman. My name is Joe Schweinhardt, Associated Oregon Industries. First of all, I think the comment was made, certain people get more money back. Well, the reason they get more money back is they pay more in taxes. The whole idea with the kicker is to be fair with the taxpayer, all taxpayers. This isn't, like it was said, a redistribution of wealth. And I think when you look at the numbers, an $80,000 average income, many of those people are double-earning families. So they're making $30,000, $40,000 a year, some of them. I think this range there, in a sense of fairness, is a middle-class number that people deserve and should get that kicker back. Like I said, if you want to look at other areas that redistribute the wealth, you can do that other ways. The kicker is not there for that reason. So that's basically my comment.
Okay. Thank you very much. That's Senator George, are you here to testify on something?
I would. You're on
3397. Oh, you're in luck. Oh, we just love this.
All right.
Yes, sir.
Oh, excuse me.
No.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is State Senator Gary George, District 12. And I was up in my office listening to testimony by the person who originated the bill. And I hope everyone was listening to some of the numbers, because we recognize that a substantial amount of the revenue that flows into the state are coming from those upper income level folks. And what I've noticed about the people of Oregon, excuse me, is that they're very fair. When Measure 88 was put out before the people, the point was made that this was going to benefit folks in the upper levels of income. Yet the people said, no, this is a factor of fairness. This is a fairness issue. And the folks who yield so much money for the state treasury, I think, should not be penalized for being so productive and yielding a tremendous amount of money to us. Now, I'm going to show you right now, if I could, Mr. Chairman, this right here, and this is post-Measure 5 spending and revenue increases.
Where do you come up with these charts?
Yeah, isn't that beautiful? Don't you love that? Paul actually helped us to get the numbers. And the important thing I want you to think about as you look at this is that when we gave some tax breaks, when we put through Measure 5, when we went out and gave some incentives to people to bring jobs and business to Oregon, they did. They did. Now, the kicker, of course, is a very sensitive factor. The people felt so strongly about it, and in November of 2000, they went out and said, I'm going to write it in the Constitution because I don't trust the legislature. And I'm going to tell you, that's what I got from people. They wanted to pass that because they didn't trust the legislature. I think we have to say no to any bill that attempts to interfere with what the people have made so clear, and that is, if you collect more taxes than you forecasted to spend, those are our dollars. And just like, for example, if it was my overpaid bill at PGE or any other company I might do business with, I want my money back. And the main thing here is We should never get into a situation where we penalize those who are yielding the best revenue into the state. So with that, I thank you very much for your time.
All right. Questions for Senator George?
Mr. Chair.
You can resist. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, this is unrelated, but that necktie won't work in the voter's pamphlet.
Oh, I can't use it?
No.
Well, because of One Nation Under God?
No, because of the stars and the flag and the patriotic.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry. That is just, you know, arts and culture may be who some of us are, but, you know, patriotism in America is who I am. So I can't, and actually right now I do look like some sort of parade, don't I?
All right. The chair's going to rule this out of order. All right. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
You bet. All right. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on 3397 and 3390.
Before you start.
Oh! I misspoke. We'll...
I'll make it really short.
Okay. Let me just kind of reopen that then for a second.
Chair Shirley and members of the committee, Marcia Kelly, the Women's Rights Coalition. I was just going to stand up and say something when Senator George came in. I think that it would behoove the committee to look at anything that deals with the kicker and equitable redistribution of wealth in the country, given what's happening on a national basis with high income. And I know although the national may get cut in half, it still is quite substantial tax breaks for those who are making lots of money. And it's difficult when you see the number of people who are increasingly living on the streets in our cities and our towns in Oregon. And to discuss the increase in spending that's happened in the state since Measure 5, which I think that's, I couldn't see because he didn't send it back there. We also have to realize that with Measure 5, we put the education on at a higher level on our general fund, and we built lots of prisons, and we have to spend money to operate those prisons. And so you always have to take that into account when you talk about the spending increases in the state post-Measure 5.
Okay.
Any questions?
That's my line. Any questions? Okay, thank you. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3397 and 3398 and open a work session on House Bill 2705. Tom Podowski, I am sorry to keep you waiting back there. Would you come on forward? And Paul, if you'll tell us what we have here, and then if you're a no, I'll need to know that so that we don't, then we'll just close the public hearing. But let's at least find out what we've got in the way of amendments today.
Okay. Mr. Chair, at your direction, I went through the two versions we had discussed of House Bill 2705. The first is Dash 1 amendments that were put forward on the House side, and the second actually is from Senate Bill 601-2, which Senator Beyer discussed with the committee when this bill was up. The 2705-1 amendments, if you recall, did several things on the first bill. It eliminated lines 28 and 29 on the first page, and then inserted language that said one of the roles of the Revenue Forecast Board is to recommend to the governor persons. Is the big change rather than persons, so mm-hmm. qualified persons. On the second page, again, of similar change was on recommendations instead of recommendation of appointing authority. That way that gives the governor some options as to select rather than simply reject or agree. On line 11 there, beginning there, lines 12 through 15 are deleted. That's what would have established. Those are references to the Council of Revenue Forecast Advisors, and that was the main thrust of this amendment, was to pull that out of statute. I think Tom has some comments about developing an alternative for that advisory group that would not be in statute. And then finally, there's a new Section 5 that makes it clear that the appointing authority at the governor would not suggest or lead to a change in the current situation that the existing state economist would be the person that would continue in that role.
That's
and then,
the Petoskey Amendment.
Yes, the Petoskey Amendment, yes. And the this would come, the appointing authority piece of this would come into play when the position is open. That's when it would first be implemented in effect. But the forecast board functions then would be to recommend persons qualified when the position is open, and secondly, the main role is to receive the quarterly economic and revenue forecast.
Okay.
The 601-2, again, there, as you recall, 601 was identical to 2705, so the language is exactly the same. This version does create some new provisions, and it does change the makeup of the Revenue Forecast Board and also changes the function of the Revenue Forecast Board. You can see there on line 6, instead of one member appointed by the Senate President, there's two members appointed, one from each of the largest caucuses in the Senate, and identical language for the House. So you'd have four legislators on this board. Members of the board who are members of the Legislative Assembly, therefore entitled to some per diem, so there would be some small fiscal associated with this. And the big substantive change in terms of the activities of the board, you can see down there on line 30, is to receive information from, provide advice to, as in the original bill, but also to provide advice to. Receive information is in the original bill, but to provide advice to is the key change. So they would have an active advisory role as well as to receiving information from the state economist. And again, as I recall from Senator Byers' testimony, this was taken from some of the language in the Washington Forecast Council. On page 2, the 601-2 version will require the state economist to present the revenue forecast to the Revenue Forecast Board, the information, the methodology, the assumptions used that go into the forecast. Again, a more extensive role for the forecast board. And the new Section 6 there would eliminate the Office of Economic Analysis, and there is some reference to the Office of Economic Analysis at one point in the statute, and that is dealing with the DUII program and assessing the balance in that program. And that's the piece I haven't recopied that, but that's the piece beginning on page 2 of the original 601-2 amendment, the Section 7, the new Section 7, that just changes that reference to the Office of Economic Analysis. And in effect, renames it as the state economist, because both of these versions would make, for the first time, the state economist an actual statutory position.
Okay. But the dash twos, for instance, leave in the language on lines 28 and 29, the dash ones delete. So these are not entirely alternative. I mean, the twos don't subsume the ones.
That's correct.
By any means.
Mr. Chair, yes, to get at the issue of that was raised by Department of Administrative Services would be you'd have to amend that so that there would be, make it clear there's candidates or persons that are eligible that be recommended.
Okay. Tom, did you want to make some comments?
Yes. For the record, my name is Tom Petoskey, State Economist. Welcome the opportunity to make some comments on 601 and 2705, actually 2705 today. In terms of how my own office is moving ahead with the sort of recommendations that have been set forth in these two bills, we are going to go ahead and form the Council of Revenue Forecast Advisors. With the composition of this council, we're looking at probably 8 to 10 people. We want to have people that are experts, grassroots in the accounting area, so that we have a sense of current accounting trends that are going on. Also, I will have some probably tax attorneys on there because of tax law changes. Also, I'm expecting to have a person from Department of Revenue for technical reasons for tax collections and laws, and also a person from LRO. Because the legislative changes that affect taxes also affect the revenue forecast. And I think it would be important to have a person at the preliminary estimates of what's going on with revenue to also be on the this advisory revenue forecast council.
Okay. Questions for Tom or for Paul? Are you Representative Virgin?
Mr. Chair, I will not be voting for this.
I think you indicated that to me earlier, and I'm counting five people here, so even if all four others said we love this, we wouldn't get this thing through. I think we will do, having seen these, especially in the hand-engrossed versions today. I'll get memos out to committee members and ask for the sense of the committee before we bring this back. And it sounds to me like you're moving substantially in the direction that this bill was going to direct anyway, and then the question I think for the committee is whether there's support for this without you.
That'd be fine. My opposition to the bill is that I feel that the state economist and the board, especially he's making recommendations and reports to the board, it's the advisory council that I have a problem with, and I think that he is at liberty to get lots of advice from any of these people without having them as an advisory board. I've served on more advisory boards than I want to count, and I don't look at them with a favorable eye, so it's not all your fault. But I simply cannot vote for the advisory board, so as well, long as it's in the bill.
I never. Okay. Okay, well, with that, I think I see the handwriting on the wall, at least as far as today is concerned, so... Committee, thank you for your patience on a Friday morning. Tom, thank you for yours.
Thank you.
And everybody else, have a good weekend. With that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2705, and we are adjourned.